Get your remote ready because Google has plans to take over your television. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We're talking technology today with Iowa State University computer consultant Jeff Ballvance. We'll find out what Google TV is all about and catch up on some other Google news, such as the 10 to the 100 award winners. Also, it looks like Apple's iPad has destroyed the market for netbooks. We'll talk about that and why we and all other tech news outlets spend so much time talking about Google and Apple. Microsoft wants us to spend some time talking about them as they make a play for market share in smartphones, and every social networking site experiences outages. How they handle those outages varies wildly. We'll also be taking your calls, 866-780-9100, Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. Join the conversation after this news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe, and we are talking technology today with Iowa State University computer consultant Jeff Ballvance. We're going to talk about Google Television and many other things Google as well, the 10 to the 100 winners. And we'll also talk about why we're always talking about Google and why we're always talking about Apple. Apple iPad seemed to have destroyed the market for netbooks. We'll talk more about that as well. Hi, Jeff. Hi, Jeff. Good morning.
Yeah. Hi there. Sorry about that.
That's all right. How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm very good. And let's start out by talking about Google Television. There's been a whole lot of buzz about it, and it's sort of been out there in the ether, and now it looks like it's becoming more and more real.
That's right. Google TV is Google provides a software platform. It provides the tools, the software tools to do this, and then several manufacturers are going to be bringing in Google TV devices. Logitech's announced a device called the Review, which is a set-top box. It's not your ordinary set-top box. It'll take an HDMI-compatible high-resolution TV to work with it, but the idea behind Google TV, and that's one of them. Sony's bringing out a couple of high-density TVs that will work with that work with Google, have Google TV built in. The idea behind Google TV, the basic idea, is search. This is what Google does best, is searching for things. And the idea is, let's search your video sources. Let's search, you want to watch a video about something. You tell it what's the video you want to watch, and it finds it, whether it finds it on your local connection from, say, your digital video recorder. Right now, the Google TV works with Dish TV, Dish Network, but will with others as time goes on, or from a streaming service like Netflix or Amazon, or from YouTube, or down the road perhaps Hulu. It doesn't matter where it is; Google TV finds it, and that's the neat thing, and it identifies that. They're already working with a batch of partners to provide applications for different channels. CNBC is online. CNN is with them. So it promises to be really interesting to be able to integrate all that together. So basically, your TV will be the TV guide. You'll just simply say, I want to watch this, and Google TV will find it.
Now, it doesn't sound to me that different from some of the other services out there. And we spent a lot of time last time you were on the air talking about some of those other services, like the Roku box and Apple TV and other ways to get this content to your television. Why is there so much excitement about it?
Well, I think the big excitement about it is that Google TV is not just a connection to services. Like the Roku box, for example, will connect you to various services. But Google TV not only includes that, but it includes a full-fledged Chrome web browser.
Okay, so it connects you to the web.
It will connect you to the web as well. It'll connect you to anything. Conceivably, you could sit down and read your mail on a Google TV, because you can access virtually any website anywhere. And it's compliant, unlike the Apple TV, it's compliant with several of the other standards, including Flash. It will have a Flash player. And so any Flash video or Flash game should be viewable or playable on a Google TV.
Okay. And when will it actually be a reality?
Well, as I say, Sony and Logitech have both made press releases I would say late 2010, early 2011 is when we're looking at things actually hitting the market.
Okay, so it will still be a while before.
Yeah, don't run out and try to buy one right now, but you may be able to reserve them soon.
All right. Well, let's talk about a few other Google things. And one of the things that hit the news this week is about Google's contest, the Project 10 to the 100. And this contest has been going on for quite some time. It was going on for about a year. And then they spent about a year judging all the entries. But the idea was that they've got $10 million and they were going to split it up amongst all the winners in different high tech categories and give them these giant grants to help make their vision a reality. And they announced the winners this past week. So we have a list of five. And I guess I was kind of struck by how these aren't most of them. There's one, but they aren't particularly wacko or crazy sounding ideas.
Well, I mean, not everybody at Google is crazy. And Google likes to provide funding for things that not only are a little far-fetched, maybe a little on the cutting edge of things, but they try to find things that do good and make sense. I mean, it all goes back to Google's do no evil corporate statement. If you're not doing evil, you have to trying to do good. And that's what they're trying to do. They're looking at things that, for the most part, are proven already. They're things that simply they have started on a small scale and simply need a little money to get things going and do some amazing things.
All right. Well, let's talk about a couple of these. You were particularly taken with the Khan Academy. What did you find out about them?
Khan Academy is a really, really interesting thing. It was started by a man named Khan, and it all started when his daughter was having trouble, or not his daughter, but his niece was having trouble in school. And they both had, you know, internet access, and they had telephone. And so he would, at night, use his computer and the telephone to tutor her in various subjects, particularly in math. I think she was having most trouble in math. And it was so cool that it worked out so well for his niece that his other niece and his nephew started working with him as well. And it got to be to the point where they couldn't link up in time for these little lessons. What he would do is he would just sit down and give a 10 to 20 minute lesson about something. And they started having problems being synchronous, being able to talk to each other. So what he did was he just recorded the lesson and posted it to YouTube. And other people found out about this and started watching them and going, hey, this guy is a really good teacher. And he kept making more and more lessons about more and more topics. He's up to 1,800 lessons now that are posted on YouTube.
And are they all by him?
They are all at this point by Khan. He's done them all himself. Right now, they're working on expanding the project. One of the things that this money will do is it'll give them the ability to take these lessons and translate them into other languages, which is something he's really wanted to do. All of these lessons are in English at this point. But to make Khan Academy a worldwide thing, he would like to translate them into other languages so people outside the English-speaking community can use them.
So you were thinking about looking up the algebra lessons to see if that was something your son would be interested in. Have you broached the subject with him?
I haven't. I mentioned it to him briefly, but I watched a few of them. The neat thing about Khan's lessons is they're not high tech. Basically, it's done with the computer equivalent of a chalkboard. And he simply writes and talks and tells stories and explains. The thing that's really neat about Khan's lessons is that he explains how all of this relates to everything else. You know, algebra can be an incredibly boring, abstract subject. Well, I shouldn't say it's boring. I mean, it's exciting to be to mathematicians. But for the rest of us, we would like to know why it's important that the line intersects the y-axis at this point. And that's the kind of thing that he brings to these lessons. He's a really good teacher, is what it boils down to.
So if story problems about trains don't do that for you,
not always,
this might be
no.
Something to check out. All right. Well, I also want to mention the one that does sound far out and wacky, which is the Schwebe project, which it sounds like it's basically a small monorail that would be constructed in an urban environment where there would be these individual pods on the monorail, and one person could hop into a pod, and it's kind of like a bicycle hanging
right.
underneath
it's
the monorail.
It's an acrylic tube bicycle hanging under a monorail. Yeah, that's one of the weirder ideas that Google has funded. But
I'd say certainly the weirdest.
You never know. I mean, one of the problems, of course, you hear all the excitement in Des Moines about the Ingersoll bike lanes. It's hard for cars and bikes to occupy the same space. Maybe the solution is to get the bikes off the road altogether and up on the rail where motorists can't hurt them.
I have a hard time imagining very many cities being willing to invest in a small monorail for something like a bike, but
you never know.
Maybe Google will prove me wrong.
That's possible.
it's very possible. Well, and I just, since we were on the subject of Google, a friend of mine introduced me to a fun little widget yesterday, which is let me Google that for you. And if you go to the site, if you Google let me Google that for you, it'll go right to the site. You go to the site and you can punch in whatever your friend or coworker has been asking you endless questions about, you can punch it into the search engine and then send them a link to the results. So if you have someone at work or a friend who always asks you questions and you think, why don't you just Google that?
Mm-hmm.
You can do that. Have you given that a try?
Oh, yes. That's very cute.
All right. Well, let's move on to Apple, since we've been talking about Google a lot. Apple's iPad seems to have destroyed the market for netbooks.
Well, that may be what's going on. The sales of small netbook computers, particularly the $300 to $400 range, Apple seems to be gutting that. The iPad is a cooler tool. You know, the market for the iPad, I think, is for netbooks, is for people who want to have a small device to carry with them. They're not necessarily considering that as their primary computer. It's a secondary device. And the iPad is, I have to admit, it may not be easier to use, but it is certainly cooler than, say, an Asus EPC. Whether that's a major factor.
Well, I think it is a major factor.
Apparently
for a lot of
is.
People. Have you had a chance to play with an iPad?
I have briefly worked with an iPad. I'm not one of the cool kids, so I didn't get one at work, but some of the other people have done, and I've seen them. There are things that they do really, really well. They're good for taking notes in a meeting. They're good for doing little presentations, as long as you don't try to use flash-formatted tools. There are certain things that they don't do very well, like, well, for example, play anything that requires flash, because that's not an option on an iPad. So it all goes back to what is it that you want to buy this device for?
Well, we're going to take a break here, and when we get back, we're going to talk about why we and almost every other tech news outlet anywhere spend so much time talking about Google and Apple, and we'd love to hear your thoughts as well. If you have any questions, you want to talk about Google or Apple or anything else out there in the universe, give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Technology Day on Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe, and I'm here with Jeff Balvance, Iowa State University computer consultant. And Jeff, we've just spent the last 15 minutes talking about Google and Apple, and I have noticed, and I'm sure many other people have noticed, that most tech news seems to be about Google and Apple these days. Why do you think they're getting so much more attention than the other companies out there?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. In Apple's case, it's probably because, for a large part, I think a lot of it is Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs is a charismatic leader, and he's just cool. When he gives the keynote at Macworld or one of the other conferences, you're always right on the edge of your seat waiting to see what he's going to come out with next. And there's always the famous just one more thing at the end of the show where he brings out the really good product. So and Apple tends to be that way. They tend to be filled with charismatic people that do cool things. They're innovative. They come on. They don't necessarily invent things. I mean, the whole concept of the Macintosh, Jobs stole that from Xerox, but they clean them up and they perfect them and they get commercial industrial designers to make beautiful packages for them, and they have more fun than I think than you do with a Microsoft product. You know, you look at Microsoft. Microsoft is a business software company in many respects. Why do we buy Microsoft? Well, we buy Microsoft because they have Exchange. They have this marvelous tool for business communications, and they have Windows, which is a marvelous tool for the kind of things that businesses do, but they're not as exciting. I have never seen anybody get excited about a Windows rollout. You don't see people lining up outside the store for a day before for a Windows launch, like you would for, say, the new iPhone 4. You saw people lining up in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think, why Apple is kind of the darling of the tech news sites. That, and I think it's because there's still this vision of Microsoft as being the evil empire. Microsoft in the old days, especially, basically did anti-competitive practices. They've been charged by various judges with that behavior, and everybody likes to hate Microsoft. And so, Apple's the alternative. The other alternative. A lot of the tech journalists go, "Oh, the open source. That's really exciting." Well, open source is really exciting. They're doing some cool things. But I think the a lot of the reason that people look at Linux and things like that and Ubuntu is it's not Microsoft, and so it's got a cool factor right there.
Right.
Google is the same way. I mean, Google is a company built by people who wrote the words "do no evil" into their mission statement, into their corporate mission statement. And whether they manage it or not, whether tempting them with billions of dollars of advertising revenue and the kind of things they could sell search information for, whether that corrupts them in the end, they still have this vision of being fun-loving people that do amazing things with search and connect you to things that you didn't believe were possible.
Well, that is funny because Google has become so incredibly dominant that you would think that there would be a backlash. And if you, maybe if you're feeling a backlash, if you feel like Google and Apple are getting too much attention, give us a call at 866-780-9100, tweet us at IPR Talk, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Or maybe you think the attention is justified. Let us know your opinion. 866-780-9100. Have you seen a lot of any backlash toward Google?
Well, I think there is starting to be backlash. I think people are getting a little nervous at the power that Google has. Google has a tremendous amount of information. Especially if you sign into a Google product, sign into Gmail. Google has the ability to track where you've been searching. They know where you've been searching. They present information to you based on where you've searched before. And so that kind of stuff is there. And it is making people nervous. People are going, "Well, do I really want to have my documents in Google Docs? Is it possible that someone will search it?" The size of the company is immense. If you look at the number of people, the number of servers they run in how many countries, the whole snafu between Google and China, they're big enough to start affecting foreign policy. And so, it does make some people nervous. And I think the difficulty is that there really isn't, for raw search, there really isn't a good alternative. Yahoo, Bing, the other search engines, they just don't have the scope and the speed and the reliability that Google has.
And we have a call from Alan in Fairfield. Hello, Alan. Oh, here we go. There we go. Hi, Alan. Are you there? No, I guess I'm having a little. There we go.
Calling in.
There you are. We're having a little phone trouble, but we've got it worked out now. Hi, Alan.
No problem. Hi. I just wanted to, let me turn the radio down. Sorry.
Thanks.
Echo here. There we go. Sorry. You came on so quick, I didn't. Anyway, there's a longstanding backlash against Google in that there's an alternative search facility that is called Scroogle, which is sort of short for Screw Google. And it's what Scroogle.org does, as this S-C-R-O-O-G-L-E, is they take the Google search results and they actually give them to you instead of, massaging them, leaving some out, and emphasizing some over others, which is what Google does. The other thing that they do is that Google saves your IP address and tags it to every search you do.
Right.
So if you've been using Google for years, Google knows exactly what you search for from your IP address. Scroogle does not do that.
That's funny. I just I punched in Scroogle.com and I got sent to Bing.
No. Scroogle.com is the wrong thing.
Okay.
The reason that happened is because there's no such thing as Scroogle.com.
Okay.
Scroogle.org is the URL. And then you click on the Scroogle scraper, which is a slightly complicated address, so it's easier to say Scroogle.org and then click on Scroogle scraper. Anyway, it's really great. The only disadvantage is that if you do a Google search, typically the search terms will appear in the address. So if you then copy the, you do a Google search, you copy the address, and then you can send that address to somebody and say, this is a search for that particular thing. In Scroogle Scraper, you can't do that, but they do have a facility that where you can do that. But on the other hand, if you do that, then you are revealing a lot of stuff to Google that otherwise would be hidden from Google. So if you're willing to fess up to who you are searching for this particular search term, then you can get a similar bookmarkable search out of Scroogle, too.
Okay.
You just go to the bottom of the search page and it says, how do I create a bookmark? You click on that, and that takes you to a special page where if you search on that page or from that page, then you get a bookmarkable search.
All right. Well, thanks for sharing, Alan.
You're welcome.
All right. Thanks a lot. So I guess we learned something new about search. That seems like a few hoops to jump through for a lot of people who feel like Google's working pretty darn well.
Well, it is. And there are other alternatives. There are lots of sites that allow you to anonymize your internet connection. So it's hard to figure out who you are. If you are really concerned about your privacy, then those extra hoops may be worth it.
All right, we've got John on the line from Beaverdale. Hello, John.
Yeah, I'm one of those who believes that Macintosh is totally overrated. They're expensive. You can't modify them. You can't hot rod them. It's a great marketing, a mediocre product. You can't build a Mac. You can't customize them that easily. You can soup up a Windows product. The Macs are expensive, they're difficult to modify, they go obsolete in a few years, and same's true with Windows stuff, but they're cheaper. I'm a professional photographer, I've been so for 25 years, I've been digital for 10. I originally went with the Windows platform because I needed other software apps, sure, business apps to run on them. Anyway, I think Windows is overrated. They look great, they're, like I said, they look great. Great marketing, mediocre product.
It's actually funny because that you're in the imaging industry, because I remember having this argument with my husband, who was then my boyfriend long, long ago, about Mac versus PC. But most of the people that I knew who were in art and design or focused on graphics liked Macs better. So do you find yourself bucking the system within your field?
Yeah, a little bit. Old habits die hard.
Yeah.
people get used to a certain thing and they don't want to get away from it. And, I was on a shoestring budget. I became my own IT guy. And, when I needed to upgrade my computer, I just go down to the local, hot rod shop and pick up the latest CPU or motherboard or disk drive or whatever. And everybody makes those for Windows platform, but not everybody makes those for Macintosh. So Macintosh is kind of caught, because you can't modify them that easily. So you have to go out and replace the entire machine. I just go out and replace you know, a few parts when they became, you know, financially feasible. Usable,
and there's a certain satisfaction to building your own machine, isn't there?
Yeah, and a lot of people aren't going to get into that. I've always been kind of a pop the hood guy, but you know, those were the advantages for me.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for your call, John.
Thank you.
All right. And Jeff, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, sure. You know, there are people who derive, you know, satisfaction from building and modifying their own computers. There are people who do the same thing about automobiles. One of the things, of course, with automobiles is that they have become more and more difficult to modify in recent years. Computers are sort of the same. Some machines are more amenable to being, you know, souped up than others. You know, it all depends on what you're good at. And bear in mind that the time you spend updating a machine rather than taking a new one out of the box is time you're not doing whatever it is you really do for a living. So those are all things that you have to weigh in the balances.
If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can weigh in on this discussion, or if you have any other tech-related questions for Jeff, give us a call at 866-780-9100. And now we've been talking about all of Mac's or Apple's gee whiz gadgets, and Windows wants to get in on that as well in the smartphone market. So Windows Phone 7 devices are coming out very soon. What are we expecting with those?
Well, Windows Phone 7 is the latest incarnation of Windows Mobile. Of course, there are plenty of Windows phones on the market now, but this will be a new generation. The idea behind it is sleeker, faster, in some respects more tablet-like. There are a couple of neat things that Windows Phone 7 will do. Of course, Windows Mobile has always been integrated nicely into business environments. You know, you have ActiveSync, so you can get your mail and your calendar and your contacts from the Exchange server that your business runs, as well as getting mail from other things. But the neat trick that Windows Phone will do will be integration with two other environments. One is Xbox Live. So for people who do a lot of gaming or do a lot of video online with their Xboxes, the phone will integrate into that environment, and you will, for example, be able to use your Netflix subscription and watch video on the phone. You'll be able to, there will be games, the online multiplayer games designed specifically for Windows Phone 7. So that will integrate that experience into, you know, into the Xbox world. The other thing that the Windows Phone 7 does is it changes the interface. Windows Mobile has always been kind of klutzy. What the Windows Phone 7 interface looks like is it looks and feels more like the Zune. If you've got a Zune media device from Microsoft, the Zune uses the same kind of tile arrangement, and so you'll feel very at home. And the neat thing is you'll be able to tie into the Zune marketplace as well. So if you've bought video or bought audio for your Zune, you'll be able to play that on your Windows Phone as well.
From my perspective, it seems like the Android phones are really giving the iPhones a run for their money, especially with this latest iPhone iteration that has become the butt of jokes everywhere. Do you think Windows 7 phones are really a competitor in that same arena?
Well, that remains to be seen. From some of the limitations that Windows Phone 7 has, I'm not sure that we'll see it be a big competitor. I could see in a couple of years maybe looking at 10% market share. That might be optimistic, might be pessimistic. I don't know. But at least one analyst has talked about just under 10 or maybe in the neighborhood of 10% of the smartphone market share. That market right now is pretty much divided between BlackBerry and iPhone, with Android starting to eat up parts of that as more and more Android phones appear on the market. Right now, I think more Android phones are actually selling than iPhones. And the big reason for that is, I think, is that more carriers support Android than iPhone. The big problem with iPhone is that if you buy an iPhone, you are tying into a contract with AT&T. AT&T's wireless coverage is not that good in many areas, especially here in Iowa.
Julie is on the line from Indianola. Hello, Julie.
Hello.
Hi there. You want to weigh in on Google?
Actually, I wanted to comment on Google and on your point about how you noticed that mostly artists and graphical artists, they're the ones that use Macintosh. And I'll tell you from my perspective, I ran my own computer services company for quite some time, and I had noticed the same thing, that most artists, photographers, even teachers, for that matter, because they're in the college setting, they like to use Macintosh over Windows. But outside of those couple of groups of people, most people had used Windows, from my experience. So I thought that was very interesting that you had said that. But to my point about Google, I think Google is the great hope out there. They are the great third-party hope in developing, well, what's it's going to be a third operating system, and your guests may know about this. It's the Chrome operating system, on top of which they've developed the Chrome browser already. But the Chrome operating system is quite remarkable. I'm actually using a distribution of it myself, and it's quite remarkable. That, including Google's development of Android, which is also open source. Very, very remarkable products from Google, and I think they deserve credit for that.
All right. Well, Julie, thank you so much for your call. We'll talk more about the Chrome operating system when we come back from a break. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We're talking about technology on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We're talking about technology today with Jeff Ballvance, a computer consultant at Iowa State University. And before the break, we were talking with Julie from Indianola about Google Chrome, the operating system. And Julie, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm still here.
What is it that you really like about the operating system?
Well, there are times when me, or I as a computer professional, I want a power system, like a Windows-based system, but when I just, you know, if I'm somewhere else in the house and I want, you know, quick access to the web, I've found that, especially with netbooks, netbooks running Linux operating systems like Ubuntu, it's just a real quick, you know, a real quick launch and there I am at the web. Well, the Google Chrome operating system, Chrome OS, is even faster. It's Linux-based. But they've cut out a lot of the layers that most computer systems have to go through as they power up and go through their system checks and so forth. And usually what happens is you launch Chrome OS, and there you have a web browser. That's basically what Chrome OS is. It's a web browser. It's a bit odd at first to work with because the operating system is just that. It's just a web browser, but it is so fast. It's so convenient. I think if Google plays it right, it could really revolutionize computers and the web for that matter. So,
All right. Julie, thank you so much for your call. And Jeff, have you played a lot around with Chrome OS?
I have not worked with Chrome OS. I've seen some videos about it. The big advantage, I think, is in Google's environment, you think about applications. Well, where are Google's applications? Google's applications are web-based. So, you know, the word processor, spreadsheet, data management stuff that we always used to say that was the core application for a desktop computer, those are available through the web, and so are a lot of other things. And the idea, I think, is that your primary applications will be in the cloud somewhere, not really on the desktop. So you really want a web browser. And Chrome is certainly a good one. Linux, the underlying pieces, certainly a good thing to base a machine on.
John is on the line from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Hello, John.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I'm new to computers. I'm an over-the-road truck driver, and you pretty much have to have a laptop anymore to be over the road. But and I've only had one for 3 months. The first month, every day I'm getting pop-up surveys and stuff like this, and you touch anything, and the next thing you know, you got a $400 bill for adding this on and adding that on. Is there any books out there you can go read or anything you can do like that to find out how I can go into these sites without end up selling the farm?
Well, one of the things that I would recommend, first of all, is to add a product to your web browser to, you know, eliminate or reduce some of the pop-ups and give you some indication of where, you know, where you can go safely. One of the products that I've had very good luck with, which is absolutely free for personal use, is something called McAfee Site Advisor. McAfee Site Advisor sits in your browser, and when you do a search on Google or Bing or Yahoo or any of the major search engines, it checks those the search results and tells you whether or not they're safe places to go. That has, for me at least, reduced the problems with pop-ups a great deal. If you really want to get serious about taking out things, there's a product called NoScript, which you can add to the browser, which simply disables things like JavaScript and ActiveX controls until you approve it for a particular site. I'd recommend those as a first start. Trend Micro has a similar product to Site Advisor. I think Kaspersky does as well. But that's something that I think you really need as an add-on to your conventional antivirus package.
Well, can you spell McAfee for us, just in case John wants to look it up?
Yes, you can find that at MCAFEE. That's McAfee's. And if I remember right, you can go to siteadvisor.com and pick up Site Advisor.
All right, John, I hope that helps you out. And Jeff, you know, I know for a long time using Firefox instead of Internet Explorer also cut down on a lot of that. Is that still as effective as it was?
That's somewhat as effective as it was. There are a lot of malicious software that targets Firefox's weaknesses. The nice thing about Firefox is that it keeps itself updated. When you start Firefox, it goes out on the net, goes back to Mozilla.com, checks to see if there's a new version, and goes ahead and installs it if there is one. And so you don't have to worry so much about keeping it up to date.
All right. Thank you so much for your call, John. I hope that helps you out. And Jason is on the line from somewhere in eastern Iowa. Hello, Jason.
How are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
I'm well. A couple quick comments. I actually work for a help desk in eastern Iowa. And we're seeing a lot of folks coming up who, either by choice or just pure accident, are using illegal copies of Windows, illegal copies of Office products. And a lot of them can't afford to buy a legal copy. Mm-hmm. And so we're suggesting for, you know, our network security as well as theirs, that they try a Linux-based operating system. There are literally thousands out there, and most of them are available where you can put it on a CD or a little thumb drive, a flash drive, pop in your computer, reboot, and it comes up on the disk, not touching your hardware, not changing anything permanently, but lets you try it out, go on the net, and see what it's all about before you install.
Yes, that's the whole live CD idea is a great tool. It's also a good thing to have a live CD around when if you simply have a machine where Windows goes bad on you, you can plug the live CD in and you're up and running and doing useful work even without a Windows that works. But yes, I that's something we've seen a lot, especially with some of our older clients. They've got an older machine. It's running Windows 98 or Windows ME or Windows 2000 is going out of support now. And do you want to buy a new computer? Well, maybe you can't. Moving to an appropriate distribution of Linux can get you more security than the version of Windows that they're running, give you legally for nothing. And I think that's a great way. It's going to be a little tricky at first, but if you look at, for example, Ubuntu, Ubuntu is very easy to use and install. For older machines, I will recommend Puppy Linux, which is a very thin but useful distribution that seems to work pretty well.
And with OpenOffice and Docs, Google Docs, if nothing else, you can open almost anything that Office would besides. For John, though, there's a tool, free tool you guys hadn't covered. It's called Sandboxy. That's Sandbox IE, totally free. And we've had a lot of folks who have had lots of repeat security issues install this, then open whichever browser through this program, and it puts a little wall around the browser so that if anything does, by accident or design, get through, it can't get anywhere else.
Sounds like a good product. I'm going to look into
that. Oh, John might want to try that out, too. Yeah. Thanks for taking a call.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Jason. And we were talking about Google Chrome and the Chrome OS earlier, and a couple of tweets on that subject is John says, it's all I recommend as an Internet Explorer alternative, installing it as default browser at our location more and more. And Nolan's MIA says, love it, speed, efficiency, great privacy options, great interfacing, and excellent and reliable tools and extensions. So it's getting a lot of very positive reviews in the Twittersphere right now. And on the subject of the Twittersphere, something else I wanted to talk about is Foursquare, which is another of the social networking sites, had a couple of major outages over the past week. And there's been some talk about how these different networking sites deal with their outages. What kind of information can they pass along to their users while they're out? Foursquare sort of used the cute approach. You know, we're all running on Red Bull here at headquarters tonight. Mm-hmm. from your perspective, I know you have to deal with outages in your world too. What can and should these sites be able to do for their users when things aren't working?
Well, I think the key to surviving outages is really to provide your clients with as much information as you can. If you're a huge organization like, you know, Facebook or Foursquare, there are easy ways to do that. You put up an additional server with for status, or maybe you use the blog. A lot of companies have blog environments for their people. You use a blog for the company. You make sure that's on a server that's not your primary system so that it's accessible if everything goes down. And you tell people what's going on. Hey, we're down. This is what's going on. We've got people working on it. We think this is what's going on. The more you can tell people, the more reassured they'll be. And really, the other thing is more than one channel. Foursquare used Twitter for a certain amount of their communications. That's a good approach. When it comes to corporate things, I'm getting more and more of the opinion that that's what Twitter's for companies. It's for rapid notifications, for stuff that needs to go out to people now. And so that's, you know, if I were running a big web service, that's what I would use Twitter for. I'd use Twitter for, we call it, at Iowa State, we call it the critical event log. When things break, things go onto the CEL, and we tell people, here's what's going on, here's our estimated time of being back on the air. And you should do that to your clients as many ways as possible. If you're a big company, it's easy. You just put up another server on another network somewhere and everything will be fine. And you tell people where this thing is so they can find it. If you're a little company, you probably don't have that option. I mean, little company, you buy a web host from somebody in Texas and that's your only channel. Well, it's not your only channel. Have a blog for your company. Put that on one of the major services, Blogspot or WordPress or something, and make that independent of your site so that it doesn't go down when the site does. And Twitter is the same way. Have a Twitter channel and send information out to people that way.
Well, I think it also speaks to how people are using these sites. Now, you know, I like Facebook. I'm a Facebook user. But if Facebook goes down, I'm okay.
Yeah, it's not the end of the world.
Right. But for a lot of people, it does seem to be pretty close to the end of the world.
That's true. I don't quite understand that. But
we're too old to understand that,
I think, Jeff. That's it. I'm too old to understand why people enjoy Facebook. Well, you know, if you didn't get to play Farmville for 4 hours, that might be.
Okay. We don't all use Facebook for Farmville. That's very cynical.
Which you will be able to do on Google TV, by the way. There's a Farmville app for Google TV.
Well, that's super news. We had another tweet about Google Chrome, and this is Courier Amy. She says, I use it at home and work, love the use of space, extensions, automatic Google search, etc. No, they're not paying me to say it. So this is something that people feel really positively about.
Well, that's good. There are a few problems with Google Chrome. I have observed that it doesn't handle the Yahoo Comics section correctly. You can't go back and forth with Google Chrome, but you can do
maybe
that
Google
with
TV will do that for
maybe
you.
Maybe they'll fix that.
And you were making fun of people for playing Farmville. Come on.
Okay.
All right. And before we run out of time, I know you wanted to mention Adobe Reader and Acrobat updates and vulnerabilities there.
Yet another set of vulnerabilities were discovered in Adobe Acrobat and Adobe Reader. And if your Adobe Download Manager hasn't updated and requested that you install the updates, I would go to the help system in Reader, and in the help menu there's a check for updates and get those updates installed, because poison PDF files are one of the biggest ways that things are getting spread right now.
So do you think that it certainly seems to me that Adobe seems to be kind of on top of that, and we were talking about how Firefox automatically updates itself. Do people ignore these updates, or do you still see that as a big problem?
In many respects, people do. They see the little flag that says install the update, and they're going, oh, no, I don't have time to do that right now. Reader updates, Adobe updates for Reader and Acrobat really don't take that long. It's worth the 2 or 3 minutes that it takes.
Okay, and I think we've got one more caller that we're going to squeak on the air here as soon as they get off the phone with our call screener, because we have just a moment to go. Well, maybe we will or we won't get a chance to talk to him. So now that we've – oh, here we go. We've got Dave on the line in Des Moines. Hello, Dave. We've got just a minute.
It's James, and I have a new i5, and – when I loaded it up and I first activated Internet Explorer, I opened up 64-bit, and now I can't get the Media Flash Player or something like that.
Okay, so you have a machine with a 64-bit version of Windows, and that's a problem. You want to make sure that you get the right version of everything. When you download, you know, applications from the web, you download drivers for your stuff, you need to make sure you've got the 64-bit versions and not the 32-bit versions, because a lot of things won't work correctly.
Well, but it says I have a 32-bit version of Internet Explorer, but now I can't open it because I opened it 64-bit. Is there any way to go back and open it?
I have to say I'm not sure. I don't know the answer to that. I'm sorry.
Okay, well, I bought it at the bookstore, so I was hoping you had an answer for me. Thanks, Jim.
Yeah,
all right,
sorry.
James, sorry about that. Well, sorry to end on a
on a down note
on
there.
A stumper there.
Well, you know, not baseball players don't bat, you know, $9.99 either, so I don't feel too bad.
So are there any new technologies that you've been trying to find time to play around with that you're hoping to get to in the near future, Jeff?
No, I've been trying to do other things with my life right now. I would like to do more with web development, because I need to know how to do that. I'd like to learn more about that. I want to learn about databases. And they're all things that people don't care about. I'm old. I've gotten to the point where technology isn't that exciting anymore.
Oh,
sorry.
No. All right, Jeff. Well, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Jeff Ball-Vance joins us once a month to talk about technology. He is an Iowa State University computer consultant. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli. Technical support and aims from Colin Araskovich. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us comments or suggestions for programs anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Coming up later today on The Exchange, a conversation with 1st District Congressman Bruce Braley. He is seeking election to his third term in Congress, and we'll also talk with his opponent, Republican challenger Ben Lang. That's coming up on The Exchange today. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, it's Horticulture Day. We're going to talk about fall chores in the garden and yard. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.